Spain, 1808. Iraq, 2003. Some thoughts on the use and abuse of history. Now, from time immemorial, the past has been a fruitful tool for all those who wish to comment on the present. You can look at the past, you can apply it to the present, and you can try to work out what is likely to happen in the future. And, in fact, all governments, all armies, all businesses, all universities are aware of their pasts and make use of them in their decision-making processes. The trouble is that the past is whatever you care to make of it. We invent history because there is no set thing which is history. And so we can make the past do whatever we want the past to do. We can manipulate the past for our own purposes. And that is very much what has happened with regard to Spain and the Peninsular War. Napoleon's takeover bid in Spain in 1808, which produces this long and bloody struggle which goes on till 1814. Now, as controversy grew over the long drawn out civil conflict that followed Iraq's overrunning in March 2003, so the growing number of commentators were horrified by the turn that events were taking, began to cast their net ever wider in their attempts to find arguments to use against President Bush and his supporters. Inevitably, perhaps, it was not long before some of them hit on the Peninsular War of 1808 to 1814 as a topic that was worthy of discussion. Napoleon, it was argued, had reasons that were in some instances deemed to be ideological and in others imperialistic, had embarked on an act of wanton aggression that, after an easy conquest, led to France becoming bogged down in a savage guerrilla war that proved militarily unwinnable, and in the end played a major role in the overthrow of the Napoleonic Empire. From here, it was but a short step to a variety of comparisons with Iraq. On the most obvious level, here too could be seen a savage guerrilla war that was proving militarily unwinnable. However, reference was also made to deeper parallels. To take just one line of argument, in Iraq, the United States and her allies were opposed by radical Muslim fundamentalists. But in Spain, had not Napoleon been opposed by equally radical Catholic fundamentalists? And if this was so, was it not because George Bush and Napoleon Bonaparte had both been engaged in campaigns that, at bottom, sought to advance values that were utterly alien to the countries which they had chosen to invade? Such questions served to create some very grim mood music that greatly encouraged the peace movement. But were the parallels really so appropriate? This paper will endeavour to answer this question, and in the process suggest that just as intelligence can be twisted so as to support the cause of military intervention, so history can be twisted to support its antithesis. Now, I'm going to skip a bit. Before going any further, that might sound as if this paper is going to be an attack on the peace movement, on the movement that opposed war in Iraq. It isn't. Actually, I'm maintaining a poise of strict neutrality. Of course, I have my own views, but in the context of this paper, I'm maintaining a poise of strict neutrality. I'm merely going to examine some of the arguments that the peace movement used, the historical arguments that the peace movement used, and show that actually they were pretty bad arguments. Arguments, above all, that never needed to be used, because the peace movement actually had perfectly good arguments founded on the present day. So this is not actually an attempt to say those of you who opposed the war were wrong. Neither is it an attempt to say that those of you who supported the war were wrong. It is merely a comment on the argument. Anyway, to reiterate, over the 6 years or 7 years now that have passed since the invasion of Iraq in March 2003, more and more commentators have spotted what they see as parallels, if you like, between the actions of Napoleon and those of George Bush. Here, for example, is the well-known American commentator, I do assure you he is well-known, commentator on military and strategic affairs, Edward Luttwak, writing in the review Harper's Magazine. Forgive me if I take a very long quote, but unfortunately it's not really a quote that allows of compression. On July the 6th, 1808, King Joseph of Spain presented a draft constitution that, for the first time in Spain's history, offered an independent judiciary, freedom of the press, and abolition of the remaining feudal privileges of the aristocracy and of the church. At that time, abbeys, monasteries, and bishops still owned every building and every piece of land in 3,148 towns and villages, which were inhabited by some of Europe's most wretched tenants, despite the fact that the new constitution would have liberated them and let them keep their harvest for themselves, the Spanish peasantry failed to rise up in its support. Instead, they obeyed the priests, who summoned them to fight against the ungodly innovations of the foreign invader. For Joseph was the brother of Napoleon Bonaparte, and had been placed on the throne by French troops. That was all that mattered to most Spaniards. Not what was proposed, but by whom it was proposed. By then, the French should have known better. In 1799, the same thing had happened in Naples, where liberals, supported by the French, were slaughtered by the very peasants and plebeians they wished to emancipate. The latter were mustered into a militia by Cardinal Fabrizio Ruffo. And I break from the quote for a moment. Not many people know this, but the word ruffian actually comes from the followers of Cardinal Ruffo. They were a very, very unruly, violent peasant militia. They were basically hillbillies who had come to town, shall we say, and proceed to paint it red. And I don't mean in paint. Ruffo easily persuaded his followers that all promises of material betterment were irrelevant because the real aim of the French and the liberals was to destroy the Catholic religion in the service of Satan. Spain's clergy did the same, and their illiterate followers could not know that the very first clause of Joseph's draft constitution had not only recognised the Roman Apostolic Catholic Church, but stated that it was the only one allowed in Spain. The same kind of politics are now in evidence in Iraq, including the ineffectual enshrinement of Islam in the new Iraqi constitution and the emergence of clerical warlords. Since the 2003 invasion, both Shiite and Sunni clerics have been repeating over and over again that the Americans have come to Iraq to destroy Islam in its cultural heartlands. Now, in common with a theme that is very strong in American treatments of the Napoleonic era, Luttwak is here tacitly accepting, firstly, that the empire stood above all for freedom and social reform, and secondly, that popular resistance to Napoleonic rule was above all the work of the Catholic Church. These are ideas to which we shall return, but if they are for the time being accepted at face value, one is left with the impression that military intervention was morally defensible. That if intervention in Spain and Iraq can be criticised, it is essentially on the grounds that there was little appreciation or understanding of the problems it would involve. Nor is Luttwak alone in giving this impression. In a review article that appeared in World Affairs, the academic historian, graduate of West Point, and erstwhile army officer, Andrew Bacevich, who's actually a bitter opponent of what he sees as the militarization of American foreign policy, nailed his colours very firmly to the mast of those who see Iraq as, at the very least, a sincere ideological crusade. If not, a great idea that has simply gone badly wrong. President Bush, he writes, qualifies as a true believer. There is little reason to doubt the conversion he experienced on 9/11. On that day, Bush was born again and committed himself without reservation to the Wilsonian mission of spreading freedom and democracy. Yet, fatally, Bush was a prisoner of both massive military misconceptions and the fact that American society was not prepared or organised for the war that the United States found itself fighting. Counterinsurgency operations, as Luttwak himself demonstrated in the article we've just cited, require enormous ground forces. Because however useful air power might may be, it is only ground forces that can infiltrate every wrinkle of the ground and destroy or otherwise eradicate the insurgency. Convinced that a rain of bombs and missiles would so demoralise those who were still bent on resistance that no such insurgency would emerge, however, Bush and his advisers planned for a short war and never gave any thought to alternative scenarios.